You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Today is National Bacon Day, so guess what we're going to be talking about? Yeah, bacon. Get some tips, recipes, and ideas to make it part of your New Year's Eve snack table coming up. Right now, it's time to talk coffee. It's a staple in households across the country, and yet coffee production is in trouble, in part because of our changing climate. A disease that used to pummel plants on the other side of the globe is now attacking crops in the Americas. Maren McKenna is an independent journalist and author. She's written two books, including Superbug and Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. She recently wrote about coffee rust for The Atlantic, and last month we spoke about the fungal disease. Some people might think that talking about coffee is superficial or tone deaf in this global pandemic. You actually acknowledge that. Why is this important to talk about coffee even in this moment?
It's not very well known that coffee crops worldwide, which are mostly coffee crops in the hemisphere of the Americas, are under threat by a disease that has been pursuing coffee around the world for about 150 years. The disease is called coffee leaf rust. It's a fungus, and it destroys harvests of coffee, not just for 1 year, but often for several years in a row. This is important, not just because so many of us depend on coffee for waking us up in the morning and managing our energy and anxiety during the day, but for several other reasons. The first is that coffee is a massive global enterprise that depends on the work, overwhelmingly, of very small farmers on small and often poor plots of land. Where they grow coffee, they have relatively few other options. So to take away their coffee plants, as this disease does, undermines an entire agricultural sector in poor parts of the world that have very few options for other things to do.
And it's a pretty big sector. I mean, 100 million people, you say, rely on this.
That's right. 100 million people around the world in some way draw their livelihood from coffee. Now, of course, that includes everything from the small farmers I've just been talking about to the giant multinational conglomerates that are the middlemen of coffee to the third wave coffee shop down the street and the barista who gives you your latte in the morning. That's a very long supply chain or value chain. But at the beginning of it are these farmers whose work is being undermined by this incredibly potent plant disease. And crucially, the reason this is happening is almost certainly because of the effect of climate change. While this disease, coffee leaf rust, has been recognized by science since the 1860s, it periodically has gotten worse with certain surges in weather. And those surges have now become dramatically worse at the same time that temperatures are rising in Central and South America and weather patterns are changing because of that warming.
This is a fungus. How much do those weather patterns you talk about matter? Does it spread more in dry years or wet years? Or what are the factors that play into this?
So it depends on temperature and on humidity. You know, if you think of the fungi that we are most familiar with, which is something like mushrooms, right? So, you know, we tend to think of mushrooms as something that grows in the garden when there's been a lot of rain. And that's equally true for the kind of fungus that coffee leaf rust is, which is a fungus that sporulates, lets go spores that drift on the wind and infect other plants and further the cycle. When it is more warm and when it is more wet, that cycle of sporulation accelerates, and also any one infection will not only produce spores more rapidly, but it will produce more spores. So warmer, wetter, less predictable weather is a favor to the disease and inimical to the livelihood of the farmers.
What does a healthy coffee plant look like? And then how do farmers realize that they're dealing with this disease?
So I spent a good bit of time last year before the pandemic began, actually in December 2019, with small-scale coffee growers in Guatemala. And maybe because it was December, which is the time when coffee is harvested from about November to about January in that part of the world, it kept occurring to me that healthy coffee plants look like Christmas trees because their leaves are a glossy dark green and the coffee cherries, the pit of which is what we think of as a coffee bean, are brilliant red. They're gorgeous and they peek out between the leaves like ornaments. It's very easy to tell when a plant is infected because those glossy, healthy, dark green leaves turn dull and kind of matte on their surface because they're desiccating, they're being deprived of nutrition. But the indicator of a coffee leaf rust infection is a spot on the leaf that starts out as just a little yellow patch and then expands. And as it expands, the leaf tissue in the center dries out and turns dark brown. And if you turn the leaf over, on the underside of that scar are the spores. And the spores are dusty and they're orange. This is why the disease is called rust. It actually looks like rust on a piece of metal. And when you run your fingers across it, it comes off in a fine orange dust in the same way that rust would on a piece of metal. And those are the spores that can break free, drift on the wind, and travel to other plants nearby.
And what happens to the plants then and their ability to produce beans?
So, you know, but leaves are how plants draw nutrition from the world, right? We all learned about that in probably elementary school biology. So when the leaves are damaged, the plant's ability to process its nutrition is damaged as well. So then it won't set fruit or won't have flowers, won't set fruit, won't produce a crop. But also because it has been sort of systemically damaged in that way, it's not just that a single harvest, a single year is damaged, that a crop is not produced, but also that since the plant has lost leaves, it will be set up badly for the next growing season. So a coffee rust attack is often something that hampers production for several years in a row.
Maren McKenna writes about public health, global health, and food policy. We're talking about how coffee leaf rust has made its way to plants in the Americas and what that means for people who make a living off of coffee, who drink this stuff. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. Maren, you talked with farmers, and in the article you wrote, you kind of focus in on one particular person. Introduce us to him.
Sure. So Elmer Gabriel is a small farmer way up in the highlands of Guatemala, sort of in the kind of the southwest corner, if you think of Guatemala as having corners. His plot, which is called Finca La Felicidad, the farm of happiness, is outside a coffee growing town, again, a very small town called San Pedro Yepocapa. And Elmer is descended from a coffee farmer. His father was a coffee farmer, and Elmer has always wanted to be one. And he has a son, Brian, who also has always wanted to be a coffee farmer. But all of their lives, the lives of these three generations, they have been dealing with coffee rust, which first came to the Americas from across the Atlantic Ocean, blowing on the breeze or traveling on imported plants. No one is really sure. Initially in the 1970s and 80s, landed in the western part of South America and moved its way up into Central America. It's an interesting historical fact that the reason that that is the center of coffee growing now is because of this disease. It was first perceived in what were at the time coffee plantations in what's now Sri Lanka in the 1860s and 70s and completely wiped out coffee growing there, 90%, 100% crop loss, to the point that Sri Lanka became a tea growing center instead. And there are people who say, historians who say, that the reason that the United Kingdom is a tea drinking nation is because of that change of Sri Lanka, which was a colonial possession, from coffee growing to tea growing as a result of the disease. So this disease wafts across the Atlantic. It moves up into Central America. In the time of Elmer's father, it was possible to keep it under control with regular application of fungicides. And because the weather was relatively predictable, they knew when to use the fungicides. But fungicides cost money. And particularly for a small farmer in a small town, they're not going to use more agricultural chemicals than they absolutely need to. So the family kind of limped along in good years and bad years, controlling the rust as much as they could. And after a while, it seemed like it wasn't that much of a problem. And Elmer bought his own farm, La Felicidad, and started growing coffee on his own. And the rust came back. And what he told me when I saw him, when I met him last year, is that it is no longer possible to control it with chemicals, that it is undermining the plants faster than they can apply, or with it would require more chemicals than they can afford. And they really have been looking at potential ruin and a potential inability of his son, Brian, to follow in his father's footsteps. In addition to this disease of coffee leaf rust, in addition to changes in weather and climate, coffee is actually not that expensive. Coffee prices are at historic lows around the world for reasons that are complex, because the pricing of coffee is a very complex algorithm. But the practical effect of that is that there's not very much money flowing back, particularly to the smaller farmers. And that means that their ability to invest more in their fields, or to buy better equipment, to buy more chemicals, possibly to buy another piece of land somewhere else, is really restricted.
We are learning about a disease known as coffee rust that has spread to coffee crops in the Americas from the other side of the globe. I spoke with journalist Maren McKenna last month about what's going on and what we can or can't do about it. Coming up, we'll hear the rest of our conversation and learn about the factors that could be contributing to the fast spread of the disease. That's coming up here on Central Time. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. This is Central Time. Right now, we continue the conversation about coffee and its uncertain future. Love it or hate it, the sounds and smells of brewing a cup of coffee are unmistakable. Yet the beans we grind up are in jeopardy worldwide, thanks to a plant disease that's making its way across the globe. Our guest is author Maren McKenna. Her work focuses on public health and food policy. She's a senior fellow at Emory University. I spoke with her in November about her piece on coffee rust. It appeared in The Atlantic. Here's the rest of our conversation. You know, Wisconsin has a lot of agriculture here. We talk about biodiversity and about adjusting the genetics of plants. When you talk about coffee plants, you give us an example also, though, of bananas. Why are we talking about them both here?
Bananas are a fairly famous cautionary tale in plant genetics. Essentially, every banana that we eat in the world, unless you happen to live in a place where bananas are literally growing in your backyard and you can walk out and pick one, but every banana that we buy in a supermarket is the same. Bananas are one giant monoculture. And the reason they're a giant monoculture is that the banana that we used to eat 100 years or so ago, when international banana shipping was becoming a thing, were all wiped out by a plant disease. So coffee's not actually that different. Coffee is based on just a couple of genetic lines. It's many, many, many plants around the world, but from a fairly narrow genetic base. And so now that it is under threat from this wide-ranging plant pathogen, coffee leaf rust, the question becomes, how does science, how do we expand the genetic base of coffee in order to make plants more resilient? And there are academic and commercial and nonprofit projects trying to do that in a variety of ways, mostly through traditional crossbreeding, which takes a while. You know, it can take you 10 years to know if a plant is good, and then another certain number of years growing it up as in various microclimates to see how well it does, if it really is as resilient, as tasty, and as prolific as coffee farmers need it to be.
So this isn't necessarily, although it involves some, human tinkering in a lab. We're talking about bringing some of the genes that already exist in other varieties of coffee plants and introducing them to try to make sure that new plants have a little bit of immunity or more resistant to the coffee rust.
Correct. So no one that I spoke to was proposing that coffee would become directly transgenic in some way. They were using more traditional crossbreeding methods. And this is important, not just for coffee. You know, throughout many, many types of things that we eat, there are relatively narrow genetic bases, but there also exist wild relatives of those food plants. They retain genes that confer resilience in a variety of ways to changes in growing seasons, to changes in temperature, to changes in day and night length, and so forth, and precipitation. One of the things I discovered when I was reporting this story that we're talking about is that the wild relatives of coffee, which are mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, which really is the historic home of coffee plants, those wild relatives are under threat as well from climate change. So just as cultivated coffee is finding that it is more vulnerable to diseases as a result of climate warming and changes in precipitation patterns, the wild relatives of coffee that could make cultivated coffee more resilient are equally under threat. And I spent some time with essentially a plant detective who goes around the world looking for wild coffee strains, and he is very troubled by what he sees. He goes to places where he found plants that were interesting 10 years ago, and there are fewer plants there or no plants there, or the forest cover that protected the plants has gone.
I'll admit, when I think of the threat of extinction, my brain usually goes to animals, but we're talking about the fact that it's possible that there are entire species of coffee plants that can go extinct, that would just be gone forever.
That's right. And because these wild relatives are in places where they've been relatively less documented or are within the national bounds of countries that have relatively less national budget to spend on surveying what they have and protecting what they have, things might wink out of existence and we might never know it until we turned around to see whether they could be useful to us and find that they are not there.
Maren McKenna has written books about food policy and the science of changing the food we grow and eat. We're talking about what's happening to coffee plants and the people who make their living off of the crop. And we're also exploring how people are trying to solve this crisis. When you were reporting this, when you think about it now and go over it, how have you reacted to learning about this huge threat to coffee and therefore this huge threat to the livelihoods of so many people?
So, you know, I have spent a lot of time reporting on aspects of the food system, but I don't think I've ever before had to focus on a crop that is so threatened and is simultaneously so much part of my daily life. You know, if you are concerned about overfishing of the oceans, you can stop eating particular types of fish. If you are concerned about very large-scale farming of meat animals, you can not eat meat that is raised in that way. But it's very hard to give up coffee. Not very many of us really could live our lives without it. I salute people who are able to do so.
Even if you can give it up, it's everywhere. There are coffee shops everywhere. There's coffee in every office. I mean, this is part of our lives.
Right. And that's what makes this problem, and what made this story so interesting to me, was that there really are very few crops that I have spent time on as a consumer or as a reporter that is so interpenetrated with my daily life. As you say, even if I didn't drink a coffee, there's probably not a neighborhood in a larger, medium-sized, or even small city anywhere in North America that doesn't have a coffee shop present somewhere within it. So it's completely interpenetrated in our urban landscape and in the commercial landscape as well. And so that made it very poignant to me that this extremely complex global problem is literally on my kitchen table every morning. And it made the difficulty of solving this real to me in a way that other things I have written about really have not been.
I think you're probably not alone. I think people listening to this will be in the same position, thinking coffee is part of my life. Now, what am I supposed to do? How do you respond to them?
Well, like a lot of complex problems, there are no simple single-step solutions, but there are things we can do. They all seem a little bit removed from the immediate difficulties of these small farmers on the sides of volcanoes in Central America. But given that one of the problems is the historic underpricing of coffee right now, a thing that people can do is to seek out and support coffee merchants that have direct lines to coffee growing properties. So that long value chain of coffee passing through many, many hands has been shortened somewhat, because then more income will get back to the farmers. And that's important, because then they can hire help, they can afford more agricultural chemicals, they can afford to give up their second jobs and literally spend more time in their fields. The other thing is that you could talk to just about any person who spends time with plant diseases or with sort of the academic research of food production and hear that agricultural research is also historically underfunded. Coffee leaf rust, and in fact, many, many plant diseases are very under-researched. There are only a handful of high-level rust mycologists pretty much in the entire world. Those few scientists, they would like there to be a lot more people like them, and they would like their plant collections and their germplasm collections appropriately supported. And if we did that, there might be some more people around to help solve the problem of the evolution and the impact of this disease, people who just are not in the pipeline now.
Maren, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Maren McKenna. I spoke with her in November, and we discussed how coffee rust is spreading around the world and what it means for coffee drinkers and coffee growers. Maren is an independent journalist and an author. She's written two books, including Superbug and Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. She wrote the story on coffee rust for The Atlantic. You can read it for yourself. We've set up a link at wpr.org/central time. Coming up, we're going to talk about how to work bacon into your New Year's celebrations at home. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up in 2020, the big screen gave us plenty to watch at home on our small screens. For the holidays, 1A is rounding up the best of the year. It's The Hit List today on 1A Plus. Listen in at 6 o'clock. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a musical family.
For the members of Tomahawk Circle, playing in a rural family band is a labor of love. This Lac-de-Flambeau Ojibwe drum group crisscrosses the country most years to share their music with an extended community of indigenous people. At powwows from Washington State to North Carolina, members of Tomahawk Circle surround a single animal hide drum and belt out songs in the Northern original style. Joe O'Connell with Chippewa Valley Museum's Sounds Like Home podcast brings us their story.
Good road music, too, when you're on traveling on your own. 20, 30-hour drives. I'm used to it. All right, my name is William Mitchell Jr. I am from Lac-de-Flambeau, Tomahawk Circle. We're like all family, legit brothers.
My name is Henry Mitchell, a singer, part of the drum.
We're brothers here. Yeah, and this is my dad.
My name is William Mitchell Sr., and I'm just a singer and a drummer.
So he's my dad.
Blake Wanape, just a singer.
Like, he's my cousin.
I'm Wilbur Mitchell.
And that's his nephew.
I'm just a singer as well.
I am the drum master, lead singer. Started this group back in 2006 when these guys were just young. There's apartment buildings not too far from where we're at, just down the road. We all grew up on it. It's the street name is Tomahawk Circle, so that's where we got our name, because we all lived within walking distance of each other back in the day when these guys were little kids. We all get together, there's at least 10 of us. That's a good amount of singers. But then if you're short on singers, like we travel, so we got like drum brothers are called.
I'm not originally from here. I'm from Casino, Wisconsin. I'm an Omni. And they just picked me up because I knew I could sing. So now I travel around with Tomahawk Circle.
And they're willing to help out or want to sing and stuff. So every pub we go to, we're pretty crewed up.
We usually go to like big contest powwows all the way from east to west coast.
It's kind of like our summer grind.
We performed in California, Connecticut, Ann Arbor, Michigan, all the way up to New York, Florida, went up to Saskatchewan, Arizona, North Carolina, Alabama, from the state of Washington all the way to east coast of New York. So we're pretty busy, you know, we try to stay busy.
Well, there's competition singing and traditional singing. Competition singing, everything's got to be perfect. Sing good, you know, you get good scores, and hopefully we do good in the contest. If we get lucky, sometimes we take home a little extra cash. Sometimes it just pays for the trip.
What money we make, we probably spend that to get there, you know, or just go represent and have a good time. And we've been there and done it, you know, that's all we can say, you know. As long as we make it back home in one piece like we came, we're good to go to the next one.
In the end, it's definitely experience and seeing, like he mentioned, our drum bros or, you know, family from across the country. You know, it's a celebration of life. Everybody gets together. You know, they sing their songs, everybody dances. And if they're hearing good music,
yeah,
you know, they
no
feel...
Oh, unless there's a drum. Get those dancers out there rocking, you hear those bells. Man, it's a good feeling. Yep, it's a good feeling.
That story about Tomahawk Circle was produced by Joe O'Connell. Portions of the music you heard come from the Tomahawk Circle CD, Just Beginning. Make sure to check out the Sounds Like Home podcast from Chippewa Valley Museum to hear a longer version of that story and more features on regional music. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
This is Central Time, and now we're talking bacon. We have your attention now. So today is National Bacon Day. According to the National Pork Board, 53% of all households in the United States have bacon on hand. That would include Homer Simpson's.
So you think you know better than this family, huh? Well, as long as you're in my house, you'll do what I do and believe what I believe. So butter your bacon.
Yes, Father.
Okay, so aside from slathering it with butter, there are lots of things you can do with bacon. You can cook it straight up a number of ways, add it to other savory dishes, even make it part of dessert. Or maybe you could make some bacon-infused vodka, like in a Bloody Mary. That's a real thing. Our next guest is talking about it, and we want to hear from you. Are you a bacon lover? How do you use it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. How do you incorporate bacon in your cooking? Do you have recommendations for party foods that involve bacon? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Eliza Cross writes about food, cooking, and other lifestyle topics. She's the author of several books, including 101 Things to Do with Bacon, 101 More Things to Do with Bacon, and Bacon, Beans, and Beer. Eliza, good to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here, and what a pleasure to be here on National Bacon Day.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time. And, you know, with dozens and dozens of things that you have identified you can do with bacon, how do you like your bacon?
I have to say that asking me to pick my favorite way to enjoy bacon is like asking a mom to pick her favorite child. Okay. There's so many different ways. We had bacon on Christmas morning, and I slow baked thick sliced bacon in the oven. And, you know, nothing fancy, but it sure was good.
Well, let's actually talk about the best ways to make bacon, because we do have some different strategies different people use. We have Ryan, who says cook the bacon in a frying pan, of course, then use the leftover grease to cook the eggs. Joel says bacon grease is liquid love when used to fry other foods. So there's the, that piece of it, right? But then, you know, Zachary says I put some parchment paper on a rimmed baking sheet, and then I cook those slices in a 400-degree oven. And Randy uses a microwave drip dish so that the bacon grease drips off of it. I mean, is there a right way?
What I love about hearing all of your listeners' different techniques is that each of those techniques produces a little bit different result. And it's really what you enjoy. Microwaving bacon tends to make it more chewy. And I kind of prefer the more crispy way of cooking it. And so oven cooking it, I go for a lower temperature, maybe 250 or 275, and give it a little more time in the oven. And that kind of renders out some of the fat and just makes it really crispy and good. And of course, you can't beat just cooking it in a good old frying pan, because then you do get those great drippings.
Let's talk about some basics of bacon. You know, we have 16 of your helpful bacon tips posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. We won't get to them all here, but there are lots of different kinds of bacon, artisanal, dry cured, nitrate free, flavored bacons. Is there a best all around kind of bacon, your go-to?
I tend to use a pretty traditional thick cut bacon. That I like the thicker cut because it doesn't overcook. It tends to cook more evenly and it's a little bit more substantial. And, you know, one of my favorite bacon producers is right in Wittenberg, Wisconsin, Newski's.
Oh, excellent. Thank you for the shout out there, based right here. And we actually have Jane from outside Green Bay on the line, ready to talk about bacon. Hey, Jane.
Hi. Okay. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to let you know that every summer, my favorite marine couple, Tim and Cindy, do what's called Porkapalooza. And the entire meal has to have pork in it. So everybody has to bring a dish. It's a competition. We have prizes and everything else for most creative, most pork loyal dish and things like that. So, I mean, every dish. And, of course, a lot of it has bacon in it because of that.
Jane, have you ever won any of the awards?
Actually, yes. But that was a while back. That was a few years ago. So I am hoping next year to I have a dish in my head with layers and layers of various types of pork in it, including bacon wrap at the last end of it.
Jane, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And, you know, I know you don't want to give anything away yet. So after you enter with that one, let us know how it worked out and if it worked for you. There's some real commitment here, Eliza, with a Porkapalooza.
I love Porkapalooza. How do I get an invitation? That sounds like so much fun.
Right?
Can I just crash? Can I crash your party?
I feel like you'd be a ringer with considering the things that you've written about bacon that, like, yeah, I think party crasher would probably be better than entrant. And we actually have some of the recipes that you've got. We want to get to them in just a little bit here. We are going to invite more people to the conversation. We're talking about bacon with Eliza Cross. She writes about food and cooking and other lifestyle topics, including 3 different books about bacon. We've got 2 of her recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. There is room for you in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite way to make bacon? How do you like to work it into your cooking? Maybe you struggle with one aspect of it, or it's just not quite the way you like it, and you need some tips. You can give us a call now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. It's National Bacon Day. And with New Year's right around the corner, we thought it would be fun to talk about how to work all of that into our New Year's celebrations at home. Eliza Cross is our guest. She writes about food, cooking, and other lifestyle topics. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And we'll go back to the phones in just a bit, but you did give us a couple of recipes, and I want to make sure to talk about this one. I think it'll go over pretty well here in Wisconsin, bacon wrapped beer brats. Walk us through this idea.
So this is a really simple recipe. You basically get some great bratwurst, some great Wisconsin bratwurst, and boil it in a little beer. And then you're going to cut it into pieces, like bite-sized pieces, and wrap those in bacon. And then I do kind of a brown sugar glaze that has a little bit of cayenne pepper to give it a little spice, and dredge them in that mixture, and then finish them off in the oven so that the bacon gets nice and crispy. And just that combination of savory, and the brats are juicy, and then you have the crispiness of the bacon and a little bit of sweet and spicy. So good.
Yeah, that sounds great. We've got that recipe up at WPR.org/Food Friday, so you can check it out there. And I want to welcome Nate to the conversation now. Nate from Fainer. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, what are you thinking about bacon today?
We just today made Bloody Marys, where we took bacon and wrapped them around a soaked wooden skewer and kind of twisted them around and then bake them in the oven on a sheet pan and then use them as a Bloody Mary. Accoutrement.
That's great. Like a Bloody Mary swizzle stick.
Right, exactly. Like a bacon swizzle stick.
A bacon swizzle that sizzles.
I think we could just keep going with that. Nate, thank you so much for sharing how you used it and on this, perfect of holidays there. Speaking of Bloody Marys, you mentioned this bacon-infused vodka for a twist on the traditional Bloody Mary. How do we do that?
It tastes so good and adds that nice smoky flavor to a Bloody Mary, and it's really easy to make at home. So basically, you'll take about a dozen slices of really good quality bacon and cook it in a skillet or in the oven until it's brown and crispy. And then you want to drain it really, really well. So squeeze it with paper towels and get as much fat out as you possibly can. And then you crumble it into a glass dish, like a casserole dish works really well. And then you're going to pour a 750 milliliter bottle, regular sized bottle of vodka, over the bacon. And then you cover it and refrigerate it for 4 days. So you give it a little stir occasionally. You can give it a little taste, see how it tastes. And then the final step is to strain out the vodka. Strain out the bacon. So you keep the vodka, of course. And I use a mesh strainer for the first straining. And then I go ahead and strain it a second time through some coffee filters. And then you can put it right back in your original bottle and you're set to go. You can mix it with your favorite bacon Bloody Mary recipe.
So the coffee filters kind of get all of those little bits out. What does the vodka look like then?
It's actually a little bit of a smoky, pale brown color because it has been marinating with that lovely, crunchy cooked bacon.
Okay. That sounds great. We are talking with Eliza Cross, who writes about food and cooking and other lifestyle topics, and we are focusing in on bacon here on National Bacon Day. And Shirley in Fenimore wants to join our conversation about bacon. Hey, Shirley.
Hi. I wanted to say, do you like side pork? Do you know what that is?
Somebody mentioned this before, and I have not had it, but it is a type of bacon that comes from the side of the pig, correct? Tell us about it.
It is not really bacon. It is the meat that you would cut up to be bacon. And it is not seasoned like bacon. And you cook it like bacon, and you cook it down until it's crisp, and it is just the pork that's between that fat, and it's so good on a sandwich with mustard.
Oh, very good. Shirley, thank you for giving us that tip on side pork, as you described it, that unseasoned bacon that you need to fry for a really long time. So many different ways to use the different forms of bacon here. There's another recipe that you gave us for skillet bacon cornbread. What's going on here?
This is a recipe that I thought would go really well for anybody who is making black-eyed peas for good luck for New Year's Day. And it's a nice, really good, tender cornbread recipe that begins with cooking some bacon in that cast iron skillet. So the cornbread has a little bit of bacon fat in it, and it also has sour cream in the recipe, which kind of gives it nice body and a little bit of tang. And then you cook the bacon and crumble it and put it back into the cornbread batter and cook it right in the oven in that skillet. And then it comes out all brown and crispy, and you can cut it into wedges, and it'll go great with your black-eyed peas.
I'm going to go here. I'm going to say these words: turkey bacon, vegetarian bacon, even vegan bacon. Are there ways to make this work, or do you just not want to talk about that?
I am totally on board with those products because, you know, we're all trying to eat as healthfully as we can. And we're all, you know, we all have different dietary restrictions and things like that. So turkey bacon and vegan bacon are, you know, great products to allow people to kind of have the experience of eating pork bacon. And, you know, they, to me, they miss the mark, but they're better than no bacon.
There's a sliding scale of best bacon to better than no bacon to no bacon. I love it. Yeah. What about with our kind of small in-house holiday parties for New Year's Eve? A couple of quick tips about party foods we could do with bacon.
Well, most of us are staying home for New Year's and, you know, maybe watching movies and taking it pretty easy. One of my favorite appetizer snacks is popcorn, and you cook the popcorn and cook some bacon on the side and crumble it. And then you combine the crumbled bacon, the popcorn, you do some melted butter mixed with a little bit of the bacon drippings from the pan and drizzle that all over, and then finish it off with some fresh grated Parmesan cheese. Mmm, it's so good. It's a perfect movie snack.
Oh, that sounds great. And how, like, is that one of those things you have to eat right away? After a little bit of time, I suppose it probably wouldn't be great anymore. Is that fair?
It's, you know, the thing that makes you want to eat it right away is the topping of the melted butter and the bacon grease. Cause that after, you know, if it sits too long, it gets a little bit soggy. So it's best just hot right out of the pan.
Yeah, and I suppose when it tastes that good, you don't really have to worry about something like
it's
that.
It's never been an issue at my house, I can tell you.
And as we wrap this up on National Bacon Day, what else do you want to mention about bacon?
Well, I would love to know what your viewers think about bacon in desserts. Mm. My publisher, when I wrote the first book, asked me to do some sweet dishes and desserts, and that was a really fun challenge. And I found that bacon tastes really good in some cookie recipes. It's really good crumbled in peanut butter cookies and really good with chocolate chip cookies. And you can also do it crumbled bacon as a layer in brownies and then do like a chocolate glaze and put some crumbled bacon on top. And that's quite good. So what do you think? Are you a fan of bacon sweets?
I tend to be one of those people that will put bacon on anything. So I think that works. And you know what? We've connected on Twitter. We'll go ahead. And if you've got an idea for this, go ahead and tweet Central Time WPR, and we'll make sure that our guest, Eliza, sees it. And I know Kent from Madison also talked about, wanted to talk about a recipe for maple syrup bacon strips. So we've got that sweet, savory combo. Eliza, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Happy National Bacon Day.
And same to you. Eliza Cross writes about food, cooking, and other lifestyle topics, including books like Bacon, Beans, and Beer. We talked to her about bacon. We've got two of her recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday, bacon-wrapped beer brats and skillet bacon cornbread. You can share your ideas on the Ideas Network Facebook page, too. I'm Keely Boltina. This is the Ideas Network, and you're listening to Central Time.